tonight on Arena with me, Ciara King. Bet Orthin and Kate Stables, the Hounds of Love at 40, and Derry Farrell plays the bouzouki live in studio. And as always, you can contact us on 51551. You can email us to arena@rte.ie, and we're on Insta at @rte_arena. Now, first up this evening, two distinct voices in contemporary folk are in Cork this weekend for Sounds from a Safe Harbour. Both Kate Stables of This Is The Kit and Beth Orton are taking part in the festival's residency, where artists live, write and rehearse together in the days leading up to their shows. For Kate Stables, she'll appear in a double headline show with Mina Tindall, as well as a sold-out performance alongside Ben Howard at Live at St Luke's. Beth Orton, whose career stretches back to the 90s, is a Brit Award winner and a Mercury Prize nominee, and she continues to evolve with each record, most recently on Weather Alive, hailed as one of her most powerful works. She plays two sold-out shows, a headline at Cypress Avenue, and Sirens, Lisa Hannigan's choral celebration of female voices at St Anne's. I'm delighted to be joined by both Beth Orton and Kate Stables from Cork.
Yay! Hi! Hi everyone!
It's great to have the both of you on Arena tonight. Beth, if I can start with you and your most recent album. You released it a couple of years ago, Weather Alive. Was this the first album you've self-produced, and how did that change things for you?
Gosh, I'm just amazed. Can I just quickly butt in and say, how is it 40 years only?
I know, Kate Bush.
Sounds of Love.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible.
She's a producer, and I remember that being the first record that I ever understood about a woman producing herself and going deep into that, and never imagining that one day I would be not anywhere near her, don't get me wrong, but, you know, dabbling in the same
I get dream. It, because it was pretty risky for her at the time as well. We'll be talking about that later on in the show. So how did you feel with Weather Alive?
Well, I mean, It was necessity over anything, because it was the lockdown, and I didn't go into it meaning to do that. It's just that I built this shed at the end of my garden, and I also recorded for a few days with a band in a studio, and it got to a point where it's like, if I don't do something with this, nothing's going to happen. And I opened up what we'd recorded, and I was working with incredible musicians, so it wasn't hard. In that respect, you know, there's some incredible material to work with, and just started to build and work remotely with people from there. And it was really liberating. And it was just like literally one step at a time, because I had no idea where it was going or what was happening. And yeah, it's wonderful. Real adventure.
Well, you're probably a lot more similar to Kate Bush than you're giving yourself credit for, you know?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Now, you've spoken openly about your health challenges and how they affected, you know, your sense of self. Yes.
Yeah.
So did music become a lifeline?
I think music is a lifeline. I really do. I think it is. I don't know. I think for many people, I think whatever side you're on, wherever you're from, whatever you're doing, it's just music is just one of those glorious things that we're so lucky to have in our lives. And yeah, it's definitely got me out of a few muddles.
Mm-hmm. And I feel sometimes, you know, when I'm listening to your music, your songs, they often feel like they carry a whole universe inside them. Do you see songwriting as a kind of continuation of your childhood imagination?
I do. I really do. I love that you asked that. When I was little, I used to play I was super bossy. I was like, you be that, you be that, you be that, I'll be this. And then I used to have endless imaginative, you know, with anything. I didn't matter what I could make a story out of anything, and I pretty much still do.
Because I was reading as well, your mother, Christine, sounds like she was a powerful influence. How does her legacy live on in your music and outlook? And can you tell me a little bit about her?
Well, she was one of those people, her whole thing was do unto others as you'd have done unto yourself, which is a simple thing to say, but actually really hard to live. And I try and hold that. She was a good woman. She just, she worked with, I don't know, she worked in the community. She would find stories of people who otherwise wouldn't be heard. And she would amplify them. I think if she was alive now, maybe she'd be considered a bit of an artist, but in her time, she just kind of did it for the love of it. I don't even know where those little books that she's put together or even where they are anymore. It's a shame.
She was an activist and she was a journalist, and she even helped to put a bill through Parliament for affordable childcare.
Yeah, she did. She did. Just before she died, she did a march across Parliament and put this bill through, and, you know, which many people are still going on to try and figure out. And but she was often ahead of her time in a lot of ways, and she was a real fighter.
Mm-hmm. And across your career, you've collaborated with everyone from William Orbit to Beck. Your music has been called everything from folktronica, which I'd never heard before, to pastoral electronica. Do you care about the labels that people put on your work? How do you feel about it?
No, not really. I don't mind at all. I guess it's, I think it's funny because, like, you know, I probably would have done better to just keep a straight line in what I did, but I have moved around, and I think that sometimes it's possibly hard to pinpoint, and it's possibly not served me to you know, but I'm just too curious because I never knew that I would be a musician. I had no idea that that was going to be my life, and when it turned out to be that way, I think I've been very lucky with the people I've worked with as well, like, you know, so it's curious how it's all panned out, but I'm just too kind of like, I have moved around a bit, but yeah, I guess the core central theme is this kind of a folk kind of, what would you say? What's the word? What's the word, Kate? A folk
legacy? No,
like that legacy. My grounding is in just, I guess, something authentic. Integrity, mm-hmm. Whatever that is.
No.
If folk music is integrity, then I like to sit there a little bit. Anyway.
You know, and speaking of legacy as well, you recently paid tribute to Marianne Faithfull in a very personal way in a new Warren Ellis film. What did performing as Tears Go By mean to you?
Oh my goodness, it was really hard. I would sing the song and Warren Ellis played fiddle, played piano with me, and I would literally just have to keep leaving the room and having a cry because, like, Marianne was still alive and she was there. And it was just, it was very emotional. It was beautiful. And to sing that song, which is, like, literally one of the first songs I ever sang along to as a little girl, aged around 9 or 10, and I had no idea. It's just so funny. Life is so funny.
And it is, you know, decades later, you end up, you know, sharing a stage and a dressing room with her. You know, it's one of those things you almost can't believe, you know, it actually
happened.
And singing
that song of all songs. Bizarre. Yeah,
no, that's incredible. And Beth, your partner, he's a musician, Sam Amidon. He's also going to be at Sounds from a Safe Harbour.
Yes.
And he was a guest on this show earlier in the year, actually. And I understand his collaboration with Chuck Dowsa led to you spending some time in Kerry. Tell me about that.
Yes, he did. He did. And now my brain has just gone blank, but it was one of the most extraordinary. I went to see their dress rehearsal and it was amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And everything was created in the moment. It was all improvisation built, and all built to some degree around the music that Sam and the rest of the band were playing, and it was the most extraordinary coming together of music and dance that I've ever seen. And that was talk of moving. That was one of the most moving productions ever, and just so beautifully choreographed. Put together. Mm-hmm. I was like, it was really inspirational.
Well, it sounds like this festival, you know, shaping up to be something like that, because you're going to perform at Cypress Avenue this Friday, but you will also join Lisa Hannigan at Sirens. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, I'm so excited. Well, today we did a little rehearsal and it's going to be beautiful. I think each person is doing a song from a female singer-songwriter that they love and one of their own songs, and there's some beautiful arrangements done of vocal arrangements, and just what a brilliant idea, you know, everyone coming together and singing together.
It's beautiful. And I mean, the lineup is absolutely incredible. You know, Lisa Hannigan, Eve Owen, Niamh Regan, yourself, you know, to name but a few, Gemma Hayes as well, Rosie Kearney's in there. And I love the thought that you'll be singing, you know, Lana Del Rey, Sinead O'Connor, some Gillian Welsh.
Brilliant. Love it.
No, it sounds incredible. Beth, thank you so much for chatting to me. Before we head and we chat to Kate, let's hear a little bit of Friday Night. That was Friday Night from Weather Alive from 2002. And now I have the great pleasure to talk to Kate Stables. Kate, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Very good.
Now, you've often spoken about your connection with Ireland. What role has it played in your music? I understand that you spent some time in Ballydehob for your latest album, Careful of Your Keepers.
Yeah, that's true. We did a lot of pre-production over there. And Joe and Caroline were kind enough to lend us their house to just live and work in for a week, and then we'd after we'd worked on the songs, got them up to scratch, we did a little gig, and it was really nice to just play them for the first time in their finished forms to a lovely bunch of people at Levis's, and then we felt ready to record them, and then that's what we did. It was really very magic. It was great.
And this residency for Sounds from a Safe Harbour, can you tell us about the other artists that you're going to be collaborating with? Because I understand you just met Beth yesterday.
Yeah, I'm really excited. And we had a lovely rehearsal this morning and I can't wait. Like, I sort of was feeling a bit anxious about this week because you just never know what's going to happen. It's, you know, I don't know. I'm just that sort of person. But now I'm here and I'm just so excited, and it's going to be a lovely gig with Beth, and I'm doing a gig with Mina Tyndall and a bunch of pals, and I can't wait to play with Ben Howard. Yeah. I feel very lucky. It's very nice, some sort of camp experience.
I'd say it's amazing. And your album, am I right in saying this, was produced by Gruff Rhys and Rosie Plain's Basslines stand out. How did their input shape your record?
Well, Rosie's input always shapes the records because she's in the band and just has quite a unique ear for melody and harmony and bass lines. Like, she, the way she's sort of come to that instrument and the way she has sort of found her path in music just means she's got her own sort of unique, I don't know, approach, which obviously everyone has, but what she does is just real gold dust. And I feel very lucky that she's up for, you know, sprinkling her gold dust into the band. And Griff is just an absolute pleasure. Like, I don't know if there's anyone else on the planet that is such a decent, creative, lovely, peaceful, generous human being. He's just so great. And just having his presence in the room and like sense of fun, but also, you know, high standards. It was just really great. I feel very lucky to have been able to make a record with him.
And, you know, you've toured with our very own Alva Reddy as well. Is there something extra special about Irish artists?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is. But I'm also sort of someone that's, I always feel uncomfortable sort of generalising and saying, you know, just making some big sweeping generalisation about Irish artists. But if I'm going to go on my own personal experience of people I've worked with and toured with and met, then, yeah, lots of very special kindness and generosity and musical talent. That's been my experience from the people I've worked with anyway from Ireland.
Well, that sounds lovely. And as I said, the festival sounds absolutely brilliant. It's one that I would absolutely love to go to. I want to thank the
Come
both of
down.
You. Do you know what? Maybe I will. I want to thank the both of you. And I just want to leave you with a track called Stuck in a Room from This Is The Kit. This place is right. Was This Is A Kit with Stuck in a Room. My thanks to Beth Orton and Kate Stables. Kate will perform with Ben Howard live at St. Luke's this Saturday and with Mina Tyndall at the Pav on Sunday. And you can catch Beth Orton this Friday at Cypress Avenue, and on Saturday she'll be at Sirens, hosted by Lisa Hannigan in St. Anne's Church. Full details on soundsfromasafeharbour.com. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Now, he has been described as one of the most important singers to emerge in Ireland in recent years. Dublin-born Derry Farrell has won the BBC Radio 2 Folk Award and performed on stages from the Royal Albert Hall in London to festivals in the US, Canada and Australia. His biggest countrywide tour to date begins this Thursday, and I'm very excited because he joins us in studio this evening. Hi, Derry.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. You've got your bouzouki with you. You ready to play?
Never go anywhere without it. Yeah.
Right, great. Absolutely. Now, you're recognised for a wonderful blend of traditional Irish and contemporary folk styles, which you've brought to a worldwide audience at this stage. What lies in store for those who have the opportunity to see you perform live on this new tour?
More of that, and hopefully a bit of, me with my nervous joking and all of that. And just kind of going to try out some maybe newer songs maybe on the audience and definitely some of the golden oldies and things like that, you know.
Maybe a bazooki bazooka joke like we were chatting
maybe
earlier.
Maybe a bazooki bazooka joke. Very careful with those, but yeah, maybe.
Now, you do play a range of instruments, but it's your distinctive voice that has brought you so much attention and recognition. Your voice is described as haunting yet powerful. And what's surprising for me is that for most of your life, you hadn't actually realised that you had a voice and a potential to be a singer.
Yeah, I always thought I was going to be a banjo player or flute player or something like that, you know. And I was just, I remember I went back to college like to study music. It was something that I always wanted to do. And when I went back there, the lecturers were saying, oh no, you're going to have to sing, like you have to sing. I was so nervous to do it, like, you know. But I went and eventually it kind of clicked and I studied it and went off, and It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. It's brought me so many places in the world, just singing, you know. Just
And you were an All-Ireland champion singer in 2013 as well. So it's lucky that you discovered that you could actually sing,
yeah,
Derry.
In County Derry.
There you go.
I think they just gave Derry the medal in Derry just to get him to stop competing or something. Yeah, great.
Now, I understand that the idea of studying music and becoming a full-time musician, it didn't seem at all likely when you were growing up. But what's fascinating is that right from your preschool years that you were drawn to music and you made friends with other children who were also musically minded. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. Back in the days of John Mooney and me pals, like from, you know, Bangor Field and that, like in Crumlin, you know, that was where I grew up, like, and we used to just kind of sit out in his garden playing the guitar. And I was always the one who was learning from them, you know. I always felt like they were showing me chords and kind of, and then Oasis kind of started happening and that. So, I mean, I'm old, like, you know, I'm not a young fella anymore, you know. So I can remember all of this, like, I can literally picture it like it was yesterday. And they're just lovely times just with the lads and, yeah, kind of.
What sort of folk music were you listening to? What Irish bands were you listening to?
I mean, I literally listened to everything from like the Bothy Band to Pavarotti to the Beastie Boys to the Prodigy, all sorts of stuff I listened to. But I was really into, like, you know, listening to that beautiful stuff from Planxty and the Bothy Band and Andy Irvine and Donal Lunny and Christy Moore and Liam O'Flynn and all of this stuff, the Fury Brothers, you know, Clancy Brothers, all that stuff. I loved it, like, you know, and it was always in the house. It was always on the record player or the tape disc, like, you know, and eventually the CD player, like, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was great. So I think listening to it is a big part of it, like, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Absorbing it.
You know, you became an electrician and things were obviously going very well for you, but there was always something that kept drawing you back to music and this longing to take things further in music.
Yeah, I mean, I was an electrician until that one day when I turned off the power to Grafton Street. that's the truth.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
What happened there?
I turned the switch off and then my boss said to
there's,
me...
So there's one switch says, for all the lights in Grafton
there's
Street.
There's one switch down underground. There was at the time. And he says, do you realise what you've just done? And I says, no, what did I do? He says, you turned off the power to Grafton Street. I was like, oh. Sorry. Found myself very quickly becoming a musician then, you know what I mean? And look, everyone makes mistakes. I made plenty of them. But just music was something that I always really wanted to try and study in that, you know what I mean? So I went back to college. I went to Ballyfermot, to the Ceoltar course in Ballyfermot. Fantastic 2 years of my life, absolutely brilliant. And then I went on from there to Dundalk and I studied music in the DKIT, and then I went on to do a master's in Limerick, in UL in Limerick. It was just kind of just snowballed one into the next, and I just kind of thought to myself then, I met a network of musicians over the years and I decided that I think I'd probably record an album. I was in a couple of different bands, and then I came out with that album then, the True Born Irishman, and it won a BBC Folk Award then, 2016. I was as gobsmacked as anybody. I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, but
who would have thought the man that turned off the lights on Grafton Street would go so far? Yeah, you know,
and I'd do it again.
Now, I want to talk to you about the bouzouki, because obviously it's an important instrument for you. You're going to be playing it here this evening. Can you tell us a little bit how you came to play it?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I suppose this is going to make me sound really old, but internet wasn't the thing that I had when I was a kid. But I always wanted to discover what that sound was in the likes of the Botty Band and Planxty and that kind of music. I really loved it, and I knew it was Andy Irvine and Donal Lunny, but I never even saw a picture of one. And then I kind of went off, and eventually I was looking at the records and I saw pictures of them, and I was like, I'd really love one of those instruments, a bouzouki, you know. But I played guitar and banjo and the mandolin and all those instruments, and then eventually I got my hands on this one. This is the actual one. This is the first one that I ever had, and it was made by a guy called Joe Foley in Churchtown. He makes bouzoukis, and it's just a wonderful instrument. I love the way it accompanies a song, you know. Either if somebody else is playing it and accompanying a song, or if I'm playing it, it also is a wonderful instrument for accompanying, you know, tunes, jigs and reels and that kind of stuff as well. And that's what I play, that's what I feel most comfortable playing.
And the bouzouki has been a feature of Irish folk music since the mid 1960s.
This is true, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you really done your homework, fair play. Yeah. And you could probably thank Johnny Moynihan, and we could thank Donal Lunny and Andy Irvine and Jimmy Crowley and these guys for this, like, you know. Mm-hmm. For the flat-backed bouzouki that I play, like, you know. And they're wonderful people as well.
Like, oh, right. Know. Okay, well, yeah. Why don't we hear a little bit of a listen? Let's listen to the instrument now. What are you going to play for us?
I'll sing a song, actually, that I recorded with Donal Lunny, a song called The Pint of Playing, which started out life as a poem, actually. And then it was given some music by a guy called Pat Good, who was a friend of mine. Great singer, great songwriter as well. And it's a song about a pint of Guinness.
There, so you go. There you are. Take it away.
Oh, when things go wrong but will not go right, though you do the best you can. And when life seems dark as the hour of night, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. When money is tight and hard to get, and your horse is also ran, and all you have is a heap of debt, well, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. And when your health is bad and your heart feels strange, and your face is pale and wan, and the doctor says you need a change, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. When food is scarce and the larder bare, and no rashers grease your pan, and your hunger grows because your meals are rare, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. Oh, and in times of trouble and lousy strife, though you still have a darling plan, you can always turn to a better life, because a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Oh, well, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Now, you went on to become a professional musician and then a solo artist. How important was the step for you to go solo?
It was huge, and it was really, really nerve-wracking for me. I remember sitting on the pier in Dingle, looking out into the sea and saying, what am I doing? I couldn't get anything to work for myself. And then I got I had met some people in Canada a couple of weeks before, and he introduced me to this lady, and over email. It was really funny the way it worked. And she said, you know, we should work together, she said, you know, and we'll try and get some gigs. And it just started there. Like, and it was incredible. Like, it was just mad the way it worked. It was kind of like I was about to go back to be an electrician. Actually, I had rang my former boss and asked him, did he have any days work? And he was saying, yeah, absolutely. He was delighted. Like, you know, he was going to take me back on and stuff. And actually went back to him for a couple of weeks, and then I started touring. But I just got really busy really quick, especially when I recorded that album, The True Born Irishman. Like, it was just, people loved it, you know. And I think if your heart is 110% into it, it kind of is an easy job. It isn't an easy job, but like, I just find that it's, I was so engrossed in music and singing that I loved it so much that it was easy, if you know what I mean.
Well, on your new tour, which begins this Thursday, you're going to perform right across the country in around 14 places. Are there some new towns and venues for you that you haven't been to yet?
There are. I mean, you know, I'm playing in Breeze and Strand Hill, and that's a new, like, that's a new one. I've been there before, but I've never actually played in there myself. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm not looking forward to the following morning to be back in Dublin Airport to go to Italy for the day. but it's going to be great as
You're
well.
You're going to
you
Italy
know?
For the day.
I'm playing Breeze and Strand Hill, then I'm coming back to Dublin. I've got a really early flight out with my band out to Italy for a festival out there, and then back on Saturday. And then the next gig I'm doing then is in the Seamus Ennis Centre on the 18th. You know?
Right. Well, so it's going that to sounds then, you know? Busy, but it sounds brilliant. Busy. And you're going to play us out now with another song, which is called Sonny's Dream.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for having me. And if anybody wants to check it out, it's just on the website www.derry.com. But sure, you know, we'll find you anyway. And thanks very much for having me on. So this is Sonny's Dream, written by Ron Hines. It goes like this. Sonny lives on a farm in a wide open space. Take off your shoes and stay out of the race, and lay down your head by that sweet river bend. Sonny always remembers the words Mama said. Oh, Sonny, don't go away, I'm here all alone. Your daddy a sailor and never comes home, and nights are so long, oh, and silence goes on. I'm feeling so tired and not all that strong. Oh, well, Sonny works the land, though he's barely a man. There ain't that much to do, but he does what he can. Oh, and he watches the sea from his room on the stairs, and the waves keep on rolling, they've done it for years and years. Miles to town, and Sonny's never been there. So he goes to the highway and he stands and he stares. And the mail comes at four. Oh, but that mailman, he's old, and still he dreams his dreams full of silver and gold. Oh, Sonny, don't go. Sailor, oh, and he never comes home, and nights are so long, and silence goes on. I'm feeling so tired and not all that strong. Old Sonny's dreams can't be real, they're just stories he's read. Stars, it is a bed. Oh, and he's hungry inside for that wide world outside. I know I can hold him. I've tried, and I've tried, and I've tried. Oh, I've tried, and I've tried.
That is beautiful. Derry Farrell, thank you so much for joining us on tonight's show. And for all information about Derry's tour, which is about to begin, just go to derry.com, which is spelled DAOIRI.com. Have a listen to this. On the 16th of September 1985, Kate Bush released her fifth studio album, Hounds of Love. She was in an interesting place in her recording career. She had poured everything, including her own money, into her previous album, The Dreaming, staked her claim as an artist on it, and it had achieved neither critical nor commercial success. We now know Hounds of Love as one of Bush's best and best-loved albums, four great singles from the five songs that make up one side, and a beautiful song cycle, The Ninth Wave, on side two. But that acclaim wasn't a given for 40 years ago when it first came out, and I'm delighted that Sinead Gleeson is with me in studio and Graeme Thompson is on the line too. Graeme is the author of Under the Ivy, which is a biography of Kate Bush. Now Sinead, it's easy to look back now and think that Kate Bush was always a legend, you know what I mean? But she must have been under serious kind of pressure writing and making Hounds of Love after The Dreaming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, The Dreaming was very experimental and people didn't take to it, not least the record company. And I think Kate had always been in this push-pull with the record company anyway, as a woman who was making her own music, you know, writing the Man with the Child in His Eyes when she was 14, writing Wuthering Heights when she was 17. So one of those few women in the charts at that time who still got on top of the pops, but was making their own songs, producing their own songs, building their own studio setup, working on their own equipment. We'll probably talk about the Fairlight in a while. But yeah, I think you can hear a lot of the fear and the trepidation, which I think is a big theme on this album, because I think she was in a place of thinking, everybody, all eyes are on me for this, including the record company. So I'll have to either do something very conformist or I'll do something very different. And it's just, that's why the album is such a sort of strange blend of two things. The songs are some of the biggest singles she ever made, and then you've got this very proggy, esoteric sort of song cycle on the B-side, which is a huge risk, but of course, as we know now, has massively paid off. I do remember there was one review of the Times, in the New York Times that said the album was slightly precious, calculated female art rock. Give you one guess as to the gender of the reviewer.
Absolutely. I feel, though, with Kate Bush, that she had to do The Dreaming in order to create Hounds of Love.
Yeah, and you can hear that very much on the second side, because this is an album of what we recognise as the big pop songs, Running Up That Hill, Hounds of Love, Cloud Busting. But there's also songs on this album that take in like Georgian folk. There's lots of use of sampling via the Fairlight. There's lots of use of various voices. There's her brother narrating a sort of a poem. It's very experimental to me, and there's all no one song sounds like the other. They all sound completely different. You can see patterns and you can see sort of complementary elements to them, but it's a lot of it wouldn't be very. It sounded very commercial, and yet as a record it really holds up as a piece of art.
So since the 1980s, you know, they were a time when artists still thought in terms of albums, as you know, as vinyl records with two sides. And when we're talking about this particular album, let's talk about how different the two sides of Hounds of Love were.
Yeah, I mean, the first side is the five songs that are the kind of the singles. And you could say, I mean, Kate herself has said these are songs about relationships. They're sort of love songs. They're dealing with themes of, you know, how you feel about the people around you, how you feel about the world around you. And then the flip side, again, we in a Spotify, you know, track skip culture, nobody will even get the idea of this sort of this opus of seven songs all feeding in together. And even some of those songs don't necessarily... they sort of butt up against each other quite deliberately. So the second side, known as the Ninth Wave, which is named after a sort of famous painting, which is the Ninth Wave, is the multiple waves you find at sea, and the ninth one is the one that will take you out. And it's this idea that she had of a woman being lost in the waves, drowning, thinking of her family, no mode of communication at that time. How do you get home? How do you tell the people you love that you're not coming back potentially? So you've got, it kind of goes sort of thematically and sonically and musically from the songs of kind of like panic and fear, and then it's sort of a little bit of like, I think this is it, I think I'm done, and then the idea of the sun coming up at the horizon at the end. So if you listen to, there's a huge narrative arc in those seven songs.
And Graeme, I want to bring you in here. Running Up the Hill, it was the first song that Kate Bush wrote for the album, and she did it in an evening because, you know, of course. And the change in surroundings and lifestyle, she'd moved house, she'd built a new studio, they were obviously all clearly working for her.
Definitely, yeah. Because as Sinead said, you know, you definitely can hear a sense of foreboding on this record, but you also get a real sense of liberation, a real sense of the elements kind of blowing through, and someone who, yeah, maybe is on the edge of make or break, but is kind of liberated by it and is definitely rejuvenated by it. And yeah, I mean, The Dreaming was the last record she ever made in a commercial studio. She built her own studio in the farm where she grew up, you know, in the barn. She used to play as a little girl. There's a beautiful connection to her childhood and her life and her family, which I think you can hear all the way through the record, actually. But you can hear it very much in Running Up That Hill, the pulse, the rhythm. And I think what she really gets to grips with in this record is that sense of rhythm, the pulse, the power all the way through it. The Dreaming is quite jagged in a way. You know, it's a beautiful record, but it'd be quite jagged. Here she really harnesses that force of the elements, in a sense, and you can hear it blowing through that song.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a lot
can.
Of the songs on that record, yeah.
And, you know, famously, the original title for Running Up That Hill was A Deal With God. What is that deal that Kate is making in the song?
Well, I get the sense of someone, you know, she's such a curious writer, in the sense that she's full of curiosity. And I just think she's putting herself in the position where she just wants to make a deal with God, where she can see from everyone's perspective. She can see from her lover's perspective on the other side of the relationship. She can see from different perspectives in humanity, sexuality, gender. I think one of the great reasons that song has resonated recently is because of the sense of binaries dissolving, which she really picks up on in that song. So I think the deal is, show me everything, you know, put me in the place of the person opposite me, let me empathize, let me feel what they're feeling. And that, you know, that's a very human thing, but it's also a great thing for a writer to try and get to grips with. You know, that I think it shows the expanse of her imagination, that she really wants to feel everything.
And she obviously had to change the title of the song because, you know, the record company were nervous that radio stations wouldn't play a title with the word God in it, yeah, because that would cause offence. But she stuck to her guns.
Well, she put it in brackets. I mean, it's one of the rare occasions where she kind of compromised, because I think, as we've heard, you know, she was in a position in her career where she did sort of have to, I think, in a sense, toe the line or just be sensible for once to play that game, because it's such a commercial song, and I think she thought, this is, you know, I'm going to pick my battles here. Maybe this is one that isn't worth fighting that hard for.
Well, this is actually the song that the record company wanted to put out first. Here's Cloud Bursting. You know, Kate Bush was a woman who didn't shy away from getting inspiration, you know, from book titles. The inspiration for Cloud Bursting came partially from a memoir with the very Kate Bush title, Book of Dreams, Sinead.
Yeah, it was based on psychoanalyst William Reich's book by his son about, and basically he had many ideas about how we think about the world and sleep and the afterlife. But I think the thing about Kate is that apart, and you can see it very much in the visual elements of her work, that wasn't just about music, it was about books, it was about film, the things she sampled. The video for this featured Donald Sutherland. EMI paid six figures to make this video. And loads of the things that she makes are actually based, you know, you can see the influence of film, you can see the influence of so many things. There's something very lullabyish and something very folkloric about that song as well. And I think it's one of those things where the album has these dichotomies, this sort of digital and bucolic, it's sort of pop and anti-pop. And I think that all of the things that she does, I mean, I always wondered if she would think she would have made a great short story writer, because there's such the theme of narrative and arc in all of the songs. And you can see it in the video. It's the same with the video for Running Up That Hill, that beautiful choreography. I mean, and she had trained with Bowie's choreographer as well. She knew how to dance. And I think it wasn't ever just about singing. It was about thinking about all the other creative elements that feed into the work. And it's all over this album.
Yeah, absolutely. Graeme, where side one has five striking individual songs, side two, The Ninth Wave, it's a different prospect. We'll hear the opening track and Dream of Sheep in a moment. But would you give us a sense of the arc of the song cycle?
Well, as Sinead described very well, you know, it's this idea of a woman who is lost at sea. And I think harking back to the loved ones that we kind of hear about on side one, you know, in Old Money off the album, you know, she's thinking about home, she's thinking about people she's been with, people she may not see again, her mother, her family. But then it goes into this very kind of dark psychodrama where she's imagining, you know, witch trials, the way women have been treated over the centuries. And then we have a song called Hello Earth where we're really panning out from her tiny little spot in the ocean right up into the clouds, and she can see the whole world. You know, she can see the whole picture. And then it ends with this beautiful bucolic hymn, really, The Morning Fog, which is about, it's a blessing, really. You know, it's a song of thanks for the simple things, the people who she's been returned to. It's an extraordinary, incredible dramatic piece. And, you know, seeing it live, as I was lucky enough to do in 2014 when she performed the whole of that suite in London, really brought so many of those elements out, you know, because obviously on a record, you're kind of piecing the pieces together a little bit yourself. But to see it dramatized so incredibly was astonishing, yeah.
And, you know, Sinead, you just heard Graham there describe it. You did see her perform The Ninth Wave in its entirety at the London gigs that he was just talking about. How do they work on stage? Because some of these songs, they're not the most obvious for a live setting.
No, and it wasn't anything like a gig. It was like a gig meets a piece of theatre, meets a piece of spectacle. They had performers, they had people in costumes. There's a wonderful, one of my favourite songs this album is Watching You Without Me. And they had a kind of set where both her son and her partner in the band were sort of, she was outside the window, which is, again, an echo of Wuthering Heights, where she's sort of, you know, her ghost has come back from the sea to sort of watch them trying to get hold of her and asking where she is. It was incredibly moving because that song again is about the departed, the people who we can't see anymore, and sort of reaching back to them across the decades. So watching it on stage, I mean, there's one point where I think what's that actor, Kevin Doyle from Downton Abbey, he was sort of doing, he's a sort of lifeguard, and he comes up on a big screen on the sea. Then the lights go out and all these kind of swooping lights go over the crowd, like, and you hear a helicopter noise. So the whole audience feels like we're immersed in the sea and the helicopter's looking for us. It was just extreme. I'd never seen anything like it. And for that song in particular, it was very, okay, very emotional. I don't think she just wanted to do a straight up gig. I don't think she's ever going to do it again. So she threw everything at it, I think.
Absolutely. Why don't we have a listen to Watching You Without Me? That was Watching You Without Me. Now, Graham, Hounds of Love was, of course, a huge hit for Kate Bush, and it sealed her idea of her ever since, you know, as an icon, a unique genius. How do you see it? Is it her masterpiece? Where does it sit in her body of work for you?
Yeah, I think inevitably it's always going to be seen as her greatest piece of work, and fair play, really. You know, I mean, I think there is an enormous amount to delve into in her catalogue. You know, she is a very, very diverse artist who has done incredible work, but if you're going to be known for one album and the most commercial album, the biggest selling album, Hounds of Love pretty much nails it. You know, it does have everything on there in some ways that she can do, you know, from the most accessible 3-minute pop song off the title track to the most beautiful ballad, you know, and Dream of Sheep, such an astonishing song, to the most out there experimental stuff. So it's not only in some ways her greatest work, it's a great primer for anyone who's coming to Kate Bush, I think. And it's at that stage where she's really getting to grips with the technology. You know, what one thing we haven't talked about is that she produced this record. You know, everything on it is her vision, from the sounds to the songs to the words. I mean, it is a quite astonishingly accomplished piece of work from all perspectives. And yeah, she's gone on to do amazing things. And I think Ariel is a much underappreciated piece of work that she made in the 2000s. But inevitably, I think Hounds of Love stands up probably higher than all of it.
Graham, thank you. Now, Sinead, very quickly, there is an Irish element to Hounds of Love in the track Jig of Life, as there is to Kate herself. Her mother was from Dungarvan.
Yeah, her mother, Hannah Daly, her family were farmers, musicians. There's still a lot of her family in that part of the world. Kate has been here many times, has lived here at times. Part of this album was recorded in Windmill Lane. There are lots of Irish musicians on it. You've got Liam O'Flynn on Little Points. You've got Donal Lunny playing the bouzouki, and Baron John Sheen of the Dubliners. And I think it was very important to her. I've interviewed her a couple of times, and she always talks about Ireland, and it seems to be very connected to it. So I think that, I mean, you know, she famously covered Milan Aaron at one point and learned to speak Irish for it. So I think that part of her culture and her ancestry is hugely important to it, and always kind of filters through. I mean, there's always a hint of it somewhere in all of the work, I think, since this album, and it's very much a present in Jig of Life.
And I want to ask you as well, you know, there's a nightmarish theme. There's, you know, a lot of feminine energy in this album. And also, as I said, an element of supernatural. Hagstone, by any chance, was it influenced by Kate Bush at all, your book?
Everything I do is influenced by Kate Bush. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something very baroque and sort of creepy and fairy tale-esque about this album. But it's also, I mean, but it's also, it's whimsical and playful, but it's also a deeply serious and technically unique album in the terms that she was doing, the equipment she was using, the way she was using them. Yeah, it is. It's a masterpiece.
All right. Well, look, thank you so much for chatting to me, Honorina. My thanks to Sinead Gleeson and to Graeme Thompson. Graeme is the author of Under the Ivy, The Life and Music of Kate Bush, published now in paperback by Omnibus Press, with a foreword by Sinead. That is all we have time for tonight, Honorina. Niall McGonigal was on sound. Our BCO is Ollie Hamilton. Research was from Paula Shields. And the show was produced by Reg Luby. The wonderful Fiacno Brennan is up next after the news.